Spinning a set of stars through which the tattered tails of axes rolls around the waxing wind that never set in motion and the unbecoming round about the season hardly matters of the wise through which the stars were set to spin.
Stuff from Henry Kaiser that goes back to 1987 album he did on SST Records called Those Who Know History Are Doomed to Repeat It. Wild dude. Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been an Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh. This show airs every Saturday night at midnight on WRCT. Thanks for tuning in. If you've enjoyed the music you've heard here tonight, check out the full playlist up on WRCT.org. And we'll catch you here next Saturday. Take care of yourselves, folks.
is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we get insight from a former CIA officer about the lessons learned and the lessons overlooked from the attacks on September 11, 2001.
Our guest is John Kiriakou, who will tell us how he paid the price for blowing the whistle on the U.S. torture program.
Armenian attorney Karnig Kerkonian discusses Azerbaijan's displacement of Armenians and the destruction of their cultural heritage. But that doesn't seem to matter to the international community, who ignores these atrocities and rewards Azerbaijan with hosting the COP29 climate conference. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
It's been 23 years this week since the attacks on 9/11 in New York City, the Pentagon, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania, killing nearly 3,000 people, injuring more than 6,000. On that day, the United States had a choice. The George W. Bush administration could have treated the attacks as a violation of U.S. and international law, launched a criminal investigation, and brought the perpetrators to justice in accordance with the rule of law. Instead, President Bush waged endless wars against Afghanistan and Iraq, pushed through Congress the USA Patriot Act, opened the notorious detention center at Guantanamo Bay, which remains to this day, rounded up Muslims and South Asians for indefinite detention, initiated a wave of civil liberties and human rights violations, and committed wholesale torture against detainees and others. To assess the legacy of 9/11 and the lessons learned and the lessons overlooked, we've invited someone who was at the center of Bush's war on terror. John Kiriakou is a journalist, former CIA counterterrorism officer, former senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and former counterterrorism consultant for ABC News. In 2007, Kiriakou blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program, telling ABC News that the CIA tortured prisoners, that torture was official U.S. government policy, and that the policy had been approved by President George W. Bush. Kiriakou knew what he was talking about. In 2002, he was responsible for the capture in Pakistan of Abu Zubaydah, then believed to be the third-ranking official in Al-Qaeda. Kiriakou became the sixth whistleblower indicted by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act of 1917, a law designed to punish spies. Kiriakou served 23 months in prison as a result of his revelations. In 2012, the Ralph Nader family honored Kiriakou with the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, an award given to individuals who, quote, advance truth and justice despite the personal risk it creates, unquote. He won the Penn Center USA's prestigious First Amendment Award in 2015, the first Blueprint International Whistleblowing Prize for Bravery and Integrity in the Public Interest in 2016, and also in 2016, the Sam Adams Award for Integrity in Intelligence, given by retired CIA, FBI, and NSA officers. Kiriakou is the author of 8 books, including The Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror, and The CIA's Insider Guide to the Iran Crisis. I met John in 2017, and we collaborated on companion reviews for the Los Angeles Review of Books of a book with the euphemistic title Enhanced Interrogation, written by James E. Mitchell and Bill Harlow, the architects of the American torture system. John, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been too long, and I'm really looking forward to a good conversation.
Well, thank you, John. To kick it off, let me begin by asking, how did you go from being a CIA counterterrorism officer who helped capture Abu Zubaydah to a whistleblower who was convicted and spent 23 months in prison? The Bush administration declined to prosecute you, but the Obama administration came after you hard. How is it that in the American legal system, you were sent to jail for telling the truth about torture, yet those who authorized and committed torture have never been charged?
Yeah, it's an upside-down world, isn't it? And there's no easy or quick answer to that. I will say that I was certainly not the only person, by far, at the CIA who objected to this torture program. And because I wasn't the only person, I waited to say something because I just expected that somebody else would come out and say something. And nobody did. In the CIA, they teach us, or the culture is such that they teach us, that everything in life is a shade of gray. And that's just simply not true. Some things are black and white. They're right or wrong. And torture, this torture program, was just simply wrong. There was no discussion about it. It was just clearly wrong, ethically, morally, legally. And I thought, well, it's so clearly wrong that certainly somebody is going to come out and say something. And they didn't. So in December of 2007, I said something in an interview with Brian Ross on ABC News. As you've noted, Stephen, the Bush administration had the FBI investigate me and my allegations for a full year, from December of 2007 to December of 2008, and they determined that I had not committed a crime. They declined to prosecute me, to the point where they actually sent my attorney what's called a declination letter, declining to prosecute. 1 month later, Barack Obama is inaugurated as president, and he named an old nemesis of mine and one of the patrons of the torture program, John Brennan, as the deputy national security advisor for counterterrorism. John later became the CIA director. I had no idea that John Brennan asked the Justice Department to secretly reopen the case against me. And then 3 years later, after my phones had been tapped all that time, my emails were being intercepted all that time, I had teams of FBI agents performing surveillance on me, I was finally arrested and charged with 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage, coming out of that ABC News interview and a subsequent interview I had given about torture to the New York Times. What we found in discovery, well, it was several fold. One, we found a series of memos between John Brennan and Eric Holder, the attorney general. In the first one, Brennan says, charge him with espionage. And then Holder wrote back and said, my people don't think he committed espionage. And then Brennan wrote back again and said, charge him anyway and make him defend himself. And that's what they did. And as soon as I went bankrupt, 10 months after being charged, they dropped those espionage charges. I hadn't committed espionage, and they knew it. Another thing we discovered was something that happened to me in 2011. I was the senior investigator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee working for John Kerry, who was the chairman at the time. And one of the wonderful things about that job is you get to have lunch with foreign diplomats all the time, and you talk about the issues of the day, and I just always loved doing that. So I was invited one day to lunch by a Japanese diplomat, the number 3 at the Japanese embassy, and his English was so bad that we had our conversation in Arabic. And so we went to a steakhouse on Capitol Hill. And I still remember the conversation. We talked about the Middle East peace process. We talked about elections in Turkey and elections in Israel. And then at the end of the lunch, he said to me, So what's next for you? And I said, well, I promised Senator Kerry that I'd give him 2 years. It's been 2.5 years. I have 5 kids I need to put through college. I think I'm going to quit and go into the private sector. And excitedly, he said, no, don't do that. If you give me information, I can give you money. And I said, what in the world is wrong with you pitching me like that? Shame on you. I'm going to report this. And I went directly, without stopping, to the office of the Senate security officer. And I said, I was just pitched by a foreign intelligence officer. He said, well, put it in writing and I'll send it to the FBI. So I sat in his office and I wrote a memo to the FBI. He sent it to the FBI. And the next day he called me and said, 2 FBI agents are going to come up and interview you. I said, great. So these 2 young agents came up to Capitol Hill and I recounted the story. And they said, okay, here's what we want you to do. We want you to invite him to lunch, try to get him to tell you exactly what information he wants and how much money he's willing to pay for it. And I said, okay. They had initially intended to be there next to me at the next table. Something came up. So they called me and they said, just write us another memo. So I did that a second time, a third time, a fourth time. And finally, in the last lunch, this diplomat said that he had been promoted, he had gotten his dream job, and he was going to be the number 2 in the Japanese embassy in Cairo. I shook his hand, wished him well, and I never saw him again. A year later, I've been arrested, and the Justice Department has sent 15,000 pages of classified discovery to my attorneys. And we learned in that discovery that there never was a Japanese diplomat. He was an FBI agent pretending to be a Japanese diplomat and trying to get me to actually commit espionage. But after every lunch, I reported in the most minute detail every sentence of our conversation back to the FBI. And then so finally, one of the FBI agents wrote to his supervisor, the now infamous Peter Strzok, I think we should end this operation. He's clearly not going to take the bait. And I said to my attorney, my lead attorney, why would they do this? I'm a patriot. And he said, because they have no case and they know they have no case. And so really that was the Obama administration's attitude toward this whole thing. It wasn't one of identifying and prosecuting or even punishing those officers who carried out not just the torture program that had been approved by the Bush administration, but who had gone over and above what was approved and who had murdered prisoners in our custody. And instead, they decided to go after the whistleblower.
On December 2014, John McCain said on the Senate floor that the American people owed you a debt of gratitude for telling them what the government was doing in their name. What did you learn from being inside the U.S. government? And why did you feel you had to go public?
That's a good question. You know, I certainly understood the difference between policy and legality. I had been in the CIA for more than a dozen years when all of this took place. I am as well read as any other educated person in the CIA. And it just seemed to me to be so crystal clear that this program was illegal. We can have disagreements and, you know, reasonable people can have disagreements over policy, but we've got the Federal Torture Act of 1946. We've got the United Nations Convention Against Torture that outlawed specifically those techniques that we were using against Al-Qaeda prisoners. And it just seemed to me that regardless of how John Yoo and Jay Bybee in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel could do handstands, that didn't make this program legal. And so that was what bothered me the most. I believe that the American people had a right to know what the CIA was doing in their name.
John, in terms of the big picture, since 9/11, What new and expanded national security tools did the U.S. government acquire under the Patriot Act and other laws and policies that continue to pose a threat to the civil liberties of Americans and human rights of people around the world?
We could probably spend an entire hour just talking about this abomination. What the government started with, and I mean this quite literally on September the 12th, was the warrantless wiretapping of the communications of what are called U.S. persons. Those are American citizens and anybody in the country on a green card. Now, not only is it illegal for NSA to collect intelligence or communications on American citizens from American citizens, it's actually a part of NSA's charter, where they are specifically prohibited in the charter from collecting such information. In fact, on September the 12th, they initiated that collection in a dragnet fashion, to the point where NSA had to build a new standalone facility in the Utah desert that has enough memory, enough computer memory, to collect and maintain every phone call, every email, and every text message from every American for the next 500 years, number one. Number two, the FBI began using something called national security letters instead of court orders or warrants. So instead of going to a judge and saying, I want access to John Kiriakou's emails, all they would do is send a letter to whatever the host was, you know, AOL, Google, Microsoft, whatever it happens to be, saying, give me John Kiriakou's email traffic in the name of national security. And they would do that. It's actually gotten worse in the last year, because these platforms, whether they are communications platforms or social media platforms, have begun selling our metadata to the FBI, the CIA, NSA. My conclusion here is we really have no protections out there at all. And even if you try to use an encrypted chat app, let's say, everybody knows that there are back doors, whether it's CIA and NSA or MI5, MI6, GCHQ in the UK, or the French, the Israelis, the Russians, the Chinese. Pick your country. There is no such thing as secure communications.
This is Stephen Rohde, and I'm with Maria Hall, and you're listening to Law and Disorder. Today, we're speaking with John Kiriakou.
What is the future of government-sanctioned torture in this country? Can you see a torture program rearing its ugly head again at some point in the future?
Oh, boy, I hate to say that the answer is yes. And I'll tell you why. It's actually quite simple. Despite the fact that we have these laws and international treaties that specifically ban torture, the Ubibe memos back in late 2001 and early 2002 turned legal precedent on its head. And so with passage of the McCain-Feinstein Amendment in 2015, I guess it was very early 2015, that was supposed to formally ban torture, what it did was it said that the military and the national security agencies can only use the interrogation techniques that are outlined in the Army Field Manual. That sounds great at first glance, but the truth is that the Army Field Manual is an executive branch document. And to change an executive branch document, so all some future president would have to do would be to sign a new national security order or an executive order, and we have torture again. I don't think that's what the Senate meant when it ratified the United Nations Convention Against Torture. We've just been lucky so far that the likes of Donald Trump didn't reimpose a torture program after specifically saying in the 2016 campaign that he would reinstate waterboarding, quote, and a hell of a lot worse, unquote.
John, on August 27, you wrote a piece for Consortium News entitled The Slide into Authoritarianism. You expanded your purview beyond the United States to look at the whole world and other countries that are ramping up the kinds of surveillance and national security efforts you're describing. You told stories of Richard Medhurst and Craig Murray. Tell our audience about both of those cases and how you see them as part of this slide into authoritarianism.
Yeah, this is very painful. What we've seen over the last 11 or 12 months is very tough to swallow. At least in this example, it seems specific to the Gaza war. So starting with Craig Murray, Craig Murray is a heroic figure. He's the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who blew the whistle on the joint CIA MI6 torture program in Uzbekistan. And he was told by the British Foreign Ministry that if he kept his mouth shut, they would make him ambassador to Denmark. If he didn't keep his mouth shut, he was going to face the wrath of the British government. And he's been imprisoned a number of times, lost his job, lost his pension, lost everything, lost his family, lost his house. But he's been a great champion for human rights. Well, he and I were supposed to meet in Iceland in October of last year, and he actually got there a day before I did. And on that day, he went to a rally in support of Palestinian human rights. We left a couple of days later, and he flew back to Glasgow. He was immediately arrested at the airport and charged under Section 7 of the Terrorism Act, simply for attending that rally in Reykjavik, Iceland, with 150 people who were marching in support of Palestinian human rights. Now, fast forward to last month, and we have the likes of Richard Medhurst, one of the bravest independent journalists out there, who has been reporting on the ground from Gaza and talking about Israeli violations of Palestinian human rights. Richard was arrested last week at Heathrow Airport, having returned to London. He lives in London. He was charged under Section 12 of the Terrorism Act. That is providing material support to a terrorist group. He faces 14 years in prison simply for writing articles about Palestinian human rights. There are others. Sarah Wilkinson, she's a pro-Palestine activist in London. She's also been charged under the Terrorism Act. And then I had my own little odd experience recently. When I first got home from prison in 2015, the Greek government hired me to help them write a new whistleblower protection law. So I flew out there four or five times that year, and we came up with a law that the Greek parliament watered down a little bit. I wasn't really happy with the result, but the European Parliament took note, and they asked if I would go to Brussels and speak to a session of the European Parliament, and they ended up passing my original draft. Well, now the Greeks are reconsidering it, and so they asked me to go back out and to meet with all of the five major Greek think tanks so we could come up with a multi-partisan, or maybe a better way to say it is non-partisan, whistleblower protection law. So I did that. And the Greeks paid my way, which means they bought the cheapest ticket that they could find. And that ticket took me to Athens through New York, which was easy and comfortable, but back to Washington through Toronto. Now, because I have a felony conviction in my past, I'm banned from Canada for life, as stupid as that sounds. I was never entering Canada. I was just transiting the airport in Toronto. And as soon as the plane landed, we got to the gate. I got up out of my seat like everybody did. And the moment I took my first step off the plane, two members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police grabbed me by the arm. Both of them. They grabbed my two arms. Come with us. I said, okay, what's up? They never spoke another word to me beyond come with us. So, I mean, imagine the looks you get when two uniformed policemen have you by the arms and they're pulling you through the airport. They took me to my connecting gate. We stood there while everybody took pictures of me and talked about me and, you know, stared at me. And then as soon as the gate opened, I was the first one on the plane. They sat me in the seat and then they stood next to the gate to ensure that I didn't get off and try to sneak into Canada or something. And then I went on my way. Now, this is a quick flight. It's an hour from Toronto to Washington. And as soon as I landed, I was pulled into secondary at Customs and Border Protection. Where did you go? I said, Greece. What did you do there? I said, I had meetings with representatives of Greek think tanks. What did you talk about? Whistleblowing. Who did you talk to? And what are their names, addresses, phone numbers, and emails? And I said, well, with all due respect, none of your damn business. And secondly, I'm an American, and you cannot legally stop me from reentering my own country. Oh, yes, we can. I said, oh, no, you can't. Well, we'll make you sit here until midnight. And I said, knock yourselves out. And so I sat there for another 45 minutes. They apparently decided it wasn't worth the fight. And they finally let me go. But I'll tell you what, now in retrospect, looking at Craig Murray and Richard Medhurst and all these other people, I got off easy.
You conclude your recent article this way, quote, we have rights, and we have to force our elected officials to force those who would take those rights away from us to respect the Constitution. This is a fight worth fighting, end quote. What can our listeners do to fight back?
You know, I keep reminding myself that our elected officials quite literally work for us. And in most cases, they're receptive to communications from constituents. We have to ride them and make sure that they understand how strongly we feel about maintaining and preserving our rights, whether they're human rights, civil rights, or civil liberties. The vote is of utmost importance here, right? Political debate is of utmost importance. And if we don't get what we want from our elected officials, then we have to take to the courts, whether as individuals or through organizations like the ACLU, for example, or any of the myriad of pro-human rights and pro-civil liberties organizations around the country. We have to fight for our rights harder than those people who fight to take our rights from us.
John, thank you so much for joining us. It's a personal privilege to know you. Thank you for alerting us to these current threats. We're grateful to people like you who have the courage to blow the whistle instead of being silent and to continue to speak out. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to hear your voice and to work with you. I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. This year, the UN Climate Conference, known as COP29, will be hosted by the Petrol Dictatorship of Azerbaijan. As COP29 delegates prepare to attend talks in the capital of Baku, the international community has a chance to shine a spotlight on Azerbaijan's abysmal human rights record, particularly given the blockade and ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh's Armenian population last year, and amid their government's escalating domestic crackdown on freedom of speech, assembly, and the press. Ironically, Azerbaijan's dictator, Ilham Aliyev, allocated $1 million to the UN Human Settlements Program one day before a UN mission visited the Nagorno-Karabakh region, who went on to report, quote, no irregularities, in spite of the entire territory being depopulated as a result of Azerbaijan's military invasion. At COP29 and beyond, there can be no climate justice without human rights, and no human rights absent climate justice. Azerbaijan ranks 154 out of 180 countries on Transparency International's Country Corruption Index. As one of the globe's top environmental and fossil fuel polluters, as recently as 2020, during the invasion of Nagorno-Karabakh, Azerbaijan used the outlawed, lethal, and environmentally hazardous white phosphorus as a chemical weapon on the native Armenian population and their highly forested environment. Ironically, in that fatal siege, which liquidated all native Armenians, the Azeri government-sponsored blockaders posed as environmental activists. But at the same time, real protesters of lethal pollution in Azerbaijan are persecuted and silenced, especially journalists and activists in advance of COP29. Joining us today to discuss the law regarding these criminal acts is attorney Karnik Kekonian, one of 23 legal advisors representing the Republic of Armenia at the International Court of Justice in 2021. Karnik's team presented their case against Azerbaijan, calling on the tribunal to take provisional remedies as a matter of extreme urgency to, quote, protect and preserve Armenia's rights and the rights of Armenians from further harm. But Azerbaijan has ignored the International Court of Justice's November 2023 ruling to, quote, take all necessary measures to prevent and punish acts of vandalism and desecration affecting Armenian cultural heritage, including but not limited to churches and other places of worship, monuments, landmarks, cemeteries, and artifacts. Attorney Kerkonian has also represented the Armenian community of Old Jerusalem in recent Israeli settler incursions upon the Armenian quarter. Karnik, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
How has Azerbaijan flouted international law through its blockade, siege, invasion, occupation, depopulation of Artsakh, imprisoning of innocent civilians, and its destruction of Christian Armenian monuments?
That's a great question, and it's one that unfortunately has not only plenty of evidence, but almost comedic ramifications. Azerbaijan is clearly a rogue authoritarian dictatorship. It has not honored any of its agreements, quite frankly, since the 2020 war, including the trilateral ceasefire agreement, its international obligations under international legal conventions, such as the CERD, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is a case pending in the International Court of Justice. You alluded to destruction of the Artsakh Armenians, which is clearly in violation and by means of starvation, which was condemned by Freedom House and the first ICC, the original ICC prosecutor, Mr. Moreno Ocampo, as acts of genocide under Article 2C of the Genocide Convention. It's failed to honor its international legal obligations, whether through convention or agreement. And that's really caused quite a destabilization in the South Caucasus. I think that there's plenty of evidence that demonstrates the genocidal intent of Ilham Aliyev. It's Azerbaijan's hereditary president who inherited the throne of Baku from his father and who has placed his wife as the vice president of Azerbaijan. And it, to be honest, it kind of reminds me of Sacha Baron Cohen's film Dictator. All critical industry is owned by the Aliyevs and his family. And so the objective here is to consolidate that power. And one of the ways to do that is by creating the Armenians as enemies. And that's what we've seen, unfortunately, this constant flouting of international legal conventions, of international law, common international law, as well as its own agreements to abide by various principles and tenets. One of the most glaring oversight, if I can put it in polite terms, is the fact that it agreed to the peaceful resolution of disputes pursuant to the OSCE principles of negotiation. instead of doing that, seeking the resolution of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, Aliyev pretty bluntly and openly, this is nothing's being hidden, he said that they solved the problem using military means. That's what he said. And so you have this really kind of open and flouting of international law with a huge amount of impunity that is only, unfortunately, being green-lighted by the rest of the international community.
And Karnig, can we deviate for a brief moment for listeners who may not know why the interest in Nagorno-Karabakh? Is oil at play?
You know, that's a great question. I think, Heidi, we have to look at it from a number of different angles. Nagorno-Karabakh, a little historical point here, I think it's worthwhile, has been an indigenous Armenian stronghold for 4,000 years. Armenians have lived there, built churches there, developed culture there, developed their religious institutions and their own self-governance there for centuries. Sure, it hasn't always been from an independent standpoint, but they've always had a constitutional and or semi-sovereign presence. It's why they're considered a people under international law, not necessarily a minority of any region. They've self-governed under various different regimes and other empires, but they've always had a unique self-governance and their ability to govern their own their own affairs. And what makes that interesting is that Nagorno-Karabakh is a land of many, I would say, riches in some ways. It does have a small mining sector, copper, molybdenum, gold, but we're not talking about South African deposits. It is also, you know, the breadbasket of the South Caucasus. There it is, verdant and beautiful hills and mountains and valleys, which are places where people, you know, generally settled, you know, thousands of years ago in those types of areas. And it's somewhat of a fortress because of the high mountains. Nagorno-Karabakh, is a combination of many different languages in terms of the word, but Nagorno means mountainous in Russian. Armenians call it Artsakh because that's where the kingdoms and the princes of Artsakh, of the region, that's what they called the area. So it does have some importance in terms of, you know, mineral deposits and things of that nature. And it's also in the middle of trade routes. And I think that's part of what's driving this in terms of the West's interest in the area and Russia's interest in the area. And there's no question that there are larger powers at play here, whether it's Russia, the United States and the West, and Iran. So it's a critical crossroads, if you will, and I think that plays a lot into it. But none of that explains what we've seen in the last 4 to 5 years, in particular, the idea of the destruction of a people. Like I said, Armenians have inhabited Nagorno-Karabakh for over 4,000 years, and there's plenty of evidence in terms of you can just look at the churches as evidence of the last 1,700 years in terms of Armenian presence, but it dates a lot further back than that. But what we've seen is a real turn, the approach that Baku has taken. There is no question that Ilham Aliyev exhibits genocidal intent, and that has been the governing principle of his efforts in the region. And it's, I think it's fair to say, well, I could take you to some interesting bookends, if you will. One is this image, which we used in the International Court of Justice case that's pending right now between Armenia and Azerbaijan, where Azerbaijan issued during the pandemic a postage stamp which depicts an exterminator in a hazmat suit actually cleansing with equipment, cleansing Nagorno-Karabakh. And it's a very frightening image, especially when you pair it with the language of dehumanization and hatred that has come out of Azerbaijan. So the real change is the idea that by military means, by military force, they can rid the region of Armenians, when I say they, the Azerbaijani ruling elite, and you have this type of dehumanization, this type of language throughout the, you know, parliamentary leaders calling Armenians rats and dogs. Actually, the president of Azerbaijan himself, Ilham Aliyev, saying that we're going to chase you out like dogs. I mean, the intent to remove the Armenians from Nagorno-Karabakh is not cloaked. It's not secret. And then when we look at kind of the immediate post-ethnic cleansing moment, you have a picture on Ilham Aliyev's own social media website, I think it was on Twitter, where he's posted himself. In the background, there's a bonfire, and the statement he's making, literally, he says it, is that he's cleansing Nagorno-Karabakh now of even the aura of Armenians after having physically removed them from the proper from the territory. So this is not a hidden agenda. I think what's changed in the region in terms of the importance of Nagorno-Karabakh is the genocidal intent, where there's been an express and not in any way cloaked understanding that he is going to remove the Artsakh Armenians, destroy the Artsakh Armenian people, and take over the territory by military means. And this is what we've seen, of course, ending with that image that I mentioned regarding Ilham Aliyev essentially gloating about the fact that he achieved the physical destruction, and now he is burning away the aura of the Armenians. You know, you couldn't write this type of rhetoric, these types of actions, and really this celebrated impunity that we have in terms of Ilham Aliyev's approach to the situation. And I think it's important to also add that for Ilham Aliyev, the destruction of the Artsakh Armenians is not the end. He calls Armenia, the country of Armenia, the sovereign territory of Armenia, he calls Armenia Western Azerbaijan openly, and this is not a secret. So this is all happening in the face of international diplomacy. It's happening in the face of international politics. There is no question that we have what I would consider a rogue authoritarian dictatorship governing Azerbaijan and looking to make more territorial claims and conquests within the South Caucasus.
Well, as you've described it, I see the two elements of genocide, the physical element, acts committed, and the mental element, the intent, demonstrated in small part by that stamp. I don't understand why many people are still calling it just ethnic cleansing.
I think that's a great point, Heidi, because I think people, I guess the layman's interpretation of what genocide is, a whole bunch of people get killed. And that's really not what's critical when you're trying to understand what genocide is. Genocide really focuses on the mens rea, as lawyers would say, right? The mental state, which you alluded to. Where you have genocidal intent, the entire rubric to understanding what is transpiring changes. Not only does it change the obligations of states, but it changes one's approach to a resolution of the conflict. And here's where I think it got really interesting with respect to the blockade. It was clear that Azerbaijan was using starvation as a method of destroying the Artsakh people. The Genocide Convention is really clear, and there is no prerequisite of how many people need to die for something to be considered a genocide. I mean, that's just silly, because where would you draw that line? The key element here is the destruction of a people, and like you said, there were plenty of acts that were committed. The intent was clearly there. In fact, the intent was there for years prior. It was not something that popped up with the war. There's plenty of evidence and reports that were published since this 2016 war. There was an attack by Azerbaijan on Nagorno-Karabakh in 2016, known as the Four-Day War, where it was followed by, where the evidence surfaced of human mutilation of corpses. And so you have all of these acts which demonstrate that there's some ideological underpinning to what is happening. This is not a war pursuant to the Geneva Conventions, right? That there's something else happening here. And the language, the rhetoric of dehumanization is one of the key aspects of that. And what we have here is this, under Article 2C, is you have, methods that are calculated to bring about the destruction of a people is considered genocide under Article 2C of the Genocide Convention, which, of course, Azerbaijan is actually a signatory to. And there is no question that starvation is a method of bringing about the destruction of a people, right? If you starve them enough, they will not be able to live. And what you have is this method, because of its surreptitiously and gradual implementation seems to kind of go unchecked because one, you have the blocking of a road, then you have the blocking off of gas and supplies, and then you have the issue with electricity, and then you have the issue with food. The key is whether or not these are part of a greater scheme. Are they part of a greater objective? And in the case of the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians, it clearly was. And Azerbaijan not only undertook the isolation and starvation of the Artsakh people in order to either create death or displacement, which both of which lead to the destruction of the people. The writing was on the wall. International Association of Genocide Scholars, the Lemkin Institute, a number of international organizations raised the genocide threat levels to 9 and 10 during the course of this nearly 10-month blockade. But what was really interesting, Heidi, is that the reaction of international players to those calls that this is a genocide in progress, it is a genocide premeditated act to destroy the Artsakh people. And if you'd like, we can get into a little bit regarding various countries' reactions, digestion of those realities on the ground.
Well, we'd like to, but I want to focus on a little positivity here, namely, what legal avenues and arguments are you and your law firm pursuing to address all the matters that you've described? And what legal entities are you approaching, or what government entities?
I think that there's kind of two real paths here. One is, you know, from an accountability standpoint, and the other is from a remedial standpoint. And those are two really kind of different approaches. And I want to talk about the remedial one first. I think one of the main things that we're interested in from a legal standpoint to keep on the international agenda and in international discourse is that the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians have a right of return to their indigenous homeland. It's been 360 whatever days. This is the first time in 4,000 years that Armenians haven't lived in Nagorno-Karabakh. I mean, this is a very significant historical fact. In the continuum of time, you know, the 400 days is something that is surmountable. I think what we have to realize is their right of return has to be understood in the context of the current reality where we have genocidal intent. And really, one of the things that we're advocating for is for the right of return to be understood as with three fundamental pillars. The first is that it has to be a collective return. There is strength in numbers, and there was a society, an entire society, a democratically elected government, and people that govern themselves. So that entire society, that there needs to be a collective return. The return needs to be under international protection. And this is where the genocidal intent is so important. One would never imagine that international law would provide for the pushing of a population into the clutches of a military and political dictatorship that is intent on destroying them. We can't make the genocidal intent disappear, no matter how much we want to. And foreign states tried to make it disappear by pretending it wasn't there. They were advocating during the blockade that the Artsakh Armenians should, quote-unquote, integrate into Azerbaijan, which is absolutely ridiculous if you take into consideration that there is genocidal intent. And this is where I think international law is really important in terms of informing diplomatic and political outcomes on the ground. So international protection is absolutely essential to protect and allow for a sustained survival of the Artsakh Armenians on their indigenous land. And the final point in terms of, in addition to it being collective and under international protection, that the people must return with their fundamental human rights. We would never expect, for example, I'll give you, the right to life is a fundamental human right, as is the right to self-determination. That is a fundamental right that people have. We would never expect people to return, push them back into to a land where we say, well, you can go back, but you have to go back without your fundamental human rights. That doesn't make sense. That's the whole point of a fundamental human right. It's the basic rights that every individual human has and every people has under international law. And so I think those are the three important fundamental pillars on the remedy side, to understand the right of return in the context of those three main factors. Then you come to the accountability side. And what we've realized throughout the process that in every genocide, and you can look through numerous examples, unfortunately we have them in the real world, you always have people that are profiting from the outcomes, aside from the political leadership and dictatorship.
We could go on for a few hours on this topic, but we only have a few minutes remaining. I'm curious, how has the awarding of COP29, the UN Climate Change Conference, relate to, what does it do for Azerbaijan's criminal and environmental polluting, and how does it reflect on the malignancy of the United Nations?
This is a slap in the face, I would say, of human rights activists and environmental activists, as well as people that want to see the UN system, the rules-based order, prevail. This is, you know, awarding Azerbaijan the ability to host COP29, this is like awarding Pol Pot of Cambodia a reforestation summit. I mean, it's completely blind to the reality on the ground. And this is something we've seen with respect to the Nagorno-Karabakh issue over and over again. I mentioned already the fact that international institutions and Western powers, quite frankly, were very much interested in ignoring the genocidal intent of Aliyev in trying to find solutions for the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict after the 2020 war. For example, saying that, well, Armenians can just integrate and coexist with Azerbaijanis. Well, that would never happen. There's not a single Armenian that hasn't been ethnically cleansed from any city that's come under the political and economic control of Azerbaijan. And there have been many, Sumgayit, Baku, Kirovabad, Nakhichevan, an entire enclave cleansed of Armenians and Armenian cemeteries and Armenian churches. So the idea that states and the UN system wants to play in this kind of fantasy, make-believe world that Aliyev and Azerbaijan are not rogue states but actual integrated international players is a real shock. And what it does is it normalizes their behavior. It's a, you know, greenwashing, if you will, of Azerbaijan's genocidal acts, Aliyev's genocidal intent. And it really creates a framework for impunity. And I think that's where the long-term impacts are going to be felt. And I'm reminded of a Senate hearing by Yuri Kim, the Assistant Secretary of State, at a Senate hearing where Senator Menendez asked Ambassador Kim what she believed Aliyev's intent was during the blockade. And this was in the midst of the blockade, 9 months later, 9 months within the blockade. And her answer was she would not be able to answer that question publicly, that she requested a private session. The fact that you have the United States, which led this rules-based order, which created it, supported it, where you have our State Department unable to state what Aliyev's intent is, what she believed Aliyev's intent was, and asked for a private session, speaks volumes. In that same testimony, she said that the United States would not countenance, and these are her words, the ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh. 5 days later, Heidi, Aliyev and Azerbaijan ethnically cleansed the entire population of Nagorno-Karabakh. And it makes for, you know, let's fast forward to COP29, and we're still playing that same game of appeasement, of greenwashing, of normalization. And when you do that, it creates this aura of impunity and cements it. And this is where we end up with destabilized regions. We end up with where we have populations that are subjected, where we have oppression. This is where it starts. When you look at autocratic fascist leaders in this particular instance turn the other way and say, well, they're just normal state players, and ignore the fact that these are rogue authoritarian dictatorships, you allow for that impunity. You aid and abet it in a lot of ways. And that's what we've seen with COP29. In violation of the Geneva Conventions, as well as treaties that Azerbaijan, ceasefire agreements that Azerbaijan itself has signed, Aliyev himself signed them, We still have Armenian prisoners of war sitting in prisons in Baku, clearly tortured. And we have civilian hostages there as well. The fact that you're holding a UN summit in Baku under these conditions is absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's almost, like I said at the start, it's almost comedic if it weren't true.
Yes, and you say aiding and abetting. I might even suggest there's a level of complicity with all of these international bodies.
You know, I would agree. There are instances where you have open knowledge, and this is, you know, and an example that I've brought before, where you have open knowledge of genocidal intent, and you are advocating, not standing aside and saying, we'll see what happens, but openly advocating to push the people into the clutches of the government that is seeking to destroy them. I do think that that goes way beyond aiding and abetting. It might even go beyond complicity, Heidi, you know, unfortunately. And that's what's happened in this particular case. Many governments knew, and their representatives on the ground knew much more than the rest of the world did, of what Aliyev was planning. Not only did they let him do it, but they also browbeat the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians into trying to make them accept subjugation as an outcome. And what they did, what the Artsakh Armenians did, is that they showed them with their feet that they are not going to take, no mother would send her child into the clutches of a regime that is intent on destroying them. That doesn't make any sense. But the reason why that didn't make any sense, Heidi, is because the governments were seeking, and very powerful governments, including the United States, were seeking to avoid the reality that Ilham Aliyev had genocide or has genocidal intent. And I think that's where the difficulty now, when you study what's happening on the borders of Armenia, where Azerbaijan has now taken villages inside sovereign Armenia and mountaintops and controlling, projecting power into sovereign Armenian territory, it's because Aliyev doesn't care whether the Armenian is from Nagorno-Karabakh or from the southern region of Sunik or Tavush. He's called all of it Western Azerbaijan. In his mind, that's his. Nagorno-Karabakh was the Sudetenland of the South Caucasus.
Oh, I'm so sorry that we've run out of time, Karnig. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, we mention a lot of the stuff that we do on social media. The Armenian Legal Defense Front is an NGO that we've just recently put together to kind of support some of the work that we're doing.
We thank you, Karnig, for your wonderful work in this difficult situation, and we will be following you on social media. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi. It was a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road in everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hi. My name is Alina Akbar Khan, and I'm a first-year MFA student here at Carnegie Mellon University. I'm recording this audio in response to my first prompt for the contextual practice seminar that we're doing this semester. And one of the first questions that I'm required to respond to is this question of transmission, or what is it that I want to transmit? Honestly, I do not have an easy answer to this question, just because I'm not going through something easy in my life right now, by which I mean that I have traveled a great distance, like quite literally more than 7,000 miles to come study here in the United States. I'm originally from Pakistan, and I just moved here less than 5 to 6 months ago. And this question of what do I want to transmit is a little difficult for me to respond to just because I think I'm adapting to a whole new culture, a whole new environment, while actively doubting my, you know, we are in a climate of political uncertainty. So I'm thinking a lot about my future. I'm thinking a lot about my present. And on that note, on the note of present, I think what I would like to transmit is an active engagement with the world around me, the world that I'm building in my studio. I'm primarily here, I mean, I'm here to learn how to be an artist. And that is an interesting position to be in, because how does one learn how to be an artist? I think I will be transmitting this experience of coming all the way here to interact and engage with communities and artists, visiting artists, lecturers, my professors and my fellow peers, all of who are dedicated to this thing that we all collectively put a lot of faith in called art. And so my engagement with this, with art itself, will probably become the content of these audio recordings for the next few weeks. Who am I? I'm an interdisciplinary artist working between Pakistan and the United States. My work is very interdisciplinary in that I mainly work between mediums such as drawing, publication, installation, sculpture, video, and sound most recently. And I'm thinking a lot about sounds, specifically because I'm also taking an elective here at School of Music called the Experimental Sound Synthesis, in which we are encouraged to think about sound in a very expanded field. And I want to especially share one particular instance from our lecture where the professor made us all do this exercise in active listening, in which we all had to close our eyes, and for 10 consecutive minutes we all had to like listen really closely to one sound source and follow it all the way to where we could hear where the sound was coming from. And interestingly, there was a sound of dripping water in the room, and I was drawn in by that sound. And then in trying to track the source of that sound, I started thinking about how water is ever present all around us, especially in us. So what sounds compose me, I think, and I'm reminded of this artist who came to give us an artist talk here, Guadalupe Maravilla, I guess, who said that our bodies are 80% water. And so what are we composed of? The sound that I'm composed of is just the vibration of water. So in a way, actively thinking about sound makes you way more aware of your own positionality within the world in a very literal way, in a way that I've really enjoyed thinking about recently in our experimental synthesis class. The prompt also requires me to respond to this question of what is the sound of home? Now, this is going to be an emotional question for me, and I don't think that I'm going to hold back on this one. Sound of